We've all heard before that the new world of social media has gutted a lot of old-school news outlets. News executives are looking for a little help. And as NPR's David Folkenflik reports, some of them are turning to one of their most relentless critics for guidance.
Jeff Jarvis is a professor and entrepreneur, but he's best known as a successful media blogger. So it should surprise no one that he's a relentless self-promoter. He wears a button on his lapel to tout his book, and he has a pretty loose definition of personal boundaries. The man blogged and Twittered about being diagnosed with prostate cancer right after informing his family. On Jarvis's blog, BuzzMachine.com, he takes shots at the newspaper industry.
You've had all that time to reinvent your products, services, and organizations for the new world. But you didn't. You blew it.
And the executives who run those papers.
Well, gentlemen, and that's pretty much all I see before me. Angry old white men.
The Associated Press Newswire.
Sorry, AP, but you're the problem.
Not even digital media are exempt.
I never liked Slate, and now I like them less. Slate.
But that one, even he regretted that very day. And in person, Jarvis proves quite affable.
Bloggers can be blunt, and I can be too blunt, but I spent a long time in the industry and my career hoping to try to see the industry move forward and take advantage of this internet.
Jarvis is author of What Would Google Do?, a book in which he took inspiration from the success of that web giant and developed a new philosophy for business. His edict for the media, oversimplified, is that they should offer news online for free, blur the line between amateur and professional, disclose personal beliefs, and do reporting in public view. Many journalists disagree, yet Jarvis gets a polite, even interested response from those he criticizes, including Gordon Krowitz, former publisher of the Wall Street Journal, whose new business venture would charge people money for the right to read articles online.
We may be at a low point now in terms of the prospects for news and an industry that, you know, very much seems besieged and uncertain as to its future. So I applaud anyone who is coming up with potential new business models and new ways to, as business people would say, monetize the content, support the journalism.
Jarvis has been testing new models for decades. At just 21, he became assistant city editor at the Chicago Tribune. He was the creative force behind Entertainment Weekly magazine and the first websites for the Advance newspaper chain, and he's been a consultant for the New York Times Company. Jarvis is now director of the Interactive Journalism Program at the City University of New York's New Graduate School of Journalism.
Rather than surrendering and believing there isn't a model, what we set out to do at CUNY was to see whether we could find sustainable business models for the future of journalism, and we believe we have. And so that's where the discussion should go now. How can we not just preserve the past of journalism, but update journalism? What does that business look like? And then, very importantly, how the hell do we build it?
Jarvis says people need to prepare for the collapse of big regional newspapers. In their place, he proposes alliances of small news websites, each intensely focused on local news. He says they can provide useful coverage and still be profitable at a much smaller combined cost than the big older newsrooms. But in making this pitch recently at an Aspen Institute conference, he faced some tough questioning from investor Esther Dyson, who asked about profits.
The numbers are unrealistically high unless you chop them in four everywhere.
And from John Leibowitz, chairman of the Federal Trade Commission.
I'm not so sure that the ecosystem that you propose, and particularly given the First Amendment values, is necessarily as good for society as some aspects of the current system. So,
yet Jarvis is pressing ahead. His virtual laboratory extends to the New York Times, where his graduate students are working on hyperlocal blogs reporting on a handful of communities in Brooklyn and suburban New Jersey. While they're relying on local residents for some content, it's an expensive experiment.
We knew that the economics, there were no economics. It was a learning process.
That's Jim Schachter, editor for Digital Initiatives at the Times.
There may be places where the economics of hyperlocal work, and Jeff and his team have found what they say are a handful of places, but there is not a universal formula that is putting food on the table for a proprietor and quality news and information on the web.
Jarvis says journalists have to be open to new definitions of their trade.
It's not about embracing me. I don't care if anybody embraces me. The problem today is there's not a good business model for the future of journalism.
If this vision doesn't work, he'll be back. Ailing news organizations are casting about for solutions, and Jarvis is full of ideas prescribing radical change. David Folkenflik, NPR News, New York.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The bandleader Paul Schaefer is used to being overshadowed by the man who introduces him on TV.
Let's see, there he is, Paul Schaefer, everybody.
Schaefer works with David Letterman, who's been in the news a bit lately. He's the sidekick, the musical director, the guy who imitates Cher.
Finally, it was time for Cher to take center stage, and it was a very beautiful scene. And she sang something like this. Ooh, holy night. That's so bright and shiny. And this was something that I always remember. Thank you very much.
We spoke with Paul Schaefer before revelations about Letterman's relationships with staffers, which means we were able to focus on Schaefer's own rich musical life. Does it annoy you that most of the music you play comes during the commercial break and I never get to hear it?
It would be nice to, you know, when I start a song to actually keep going instead of fading out into a downy fabric softener thing.
In past years, Schaefer was on Saturday Night Live and part of the Blues Brothers. In a memoir called We'll Be Here for the Rest of Our Lives, he recounts how he started his career playing piano in a Canadian topless bar.
I was right out of school. I went to University of Toronto, really, you know, wanted to go into music, barely had the nerve to do it, so I said to my parents, I'll take a year and see what happens. Well, first thing that happened in the year was I got that job in the Brass Rail Tavern on Yonge Street in Toronto. And, man, that was a bizarre job. Sort of exciting. Of course, you know, girls get up on the stage and take off their tops. And all my friends showed up. You know,
they were just coming for the piano play.
I had no idea that they were so interested in my music. But there they were, ringside, you know. And then at the end of the night, you know, the friends are still there. They're all a little drunk. I'm embarrassed. You know, and I'm saying, please come back and see us. We're happy to have entertained you this evening, and we will be here. And it really felt like it for the rest of our lives. And that's my co-writer David Ritz said, there's your title for the book.
Well, now, how did you get from the topless bar to, well, somewhat more high-class work? Let's talk about the musical Godspell.
While I was playing in the topless bar, I also used to be an audition pianist and kind of a vocal coach. And for $20, you could come over to my house and I would rehearse a song with you and then accompany you to your audition. I'd play piano for you. But I had a girlfriend who was going to audition for Godspell and another gal, a friend named Avril, who I'd met on this bizarre tour of Canadian missile bases. And you got to read the book to hear about that. But we went and auditioned. And Stephen Schwartz, very well known now, he has Wicked running on Broadway. He composed that music. He's won a number of Oscars for animated movies. Anyway, he was in town for the final auditions, and he said, hey, I want to talk to the piano player. And he ended up hiring me out of that audition and hired me to be the conductor for the show. And I had never done that before, but it was very heady stuff, and I was thrilled. Next thing I know, I was at the Royal Royal Alex Theatre. Beautiful theatre in Toronto, conducting Godspell, and here I am.
You know, I would think that there are plenty of talented piano players who can't necessarily conduct anything, lead other musicians, lead a band. What did he see in your piano playing that made him think that you could be a leader?
The main thing he liked about my piano playing was that I was a rock and roll pianist. His score was rock and roll, and I could bang it out. So he liked that. I was not a theatrical pianist. In other words, you know, I hit the keys hard. And he just kind of got a kick out of me. He said, can you conduct? I said, yes. I don't know, you know. When a person asks you a question like that, you say yes.
I want to go back to one of the earliest stories that you tell on yourself, your competition with a young man named Marvin Slabotsky. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yeah.
Who was he, and where are you competing with him?
Well, he was another kid in Thunder Bay, Ontario, and he was also a member of our synagogue. In the synagogue, there would be community events and sometimes sort of talent shows, and I was, you know, a little pianist, and he was a pianist, too, and he was actually terrific, you know, and he would play this song, Jealousy, and he'd get up, and he would just... Da-da, dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum- 11 years old, and I'd get up, and that's the way the reaction was. And I would say to myself, you know, I've got to do something. You know, this kid Marvin Slabotsky is walking all over me. And then I saw on the Ed Sullivan Show the grand twins of the twin grands, Ferranti and Teicher, doing the theme from Exodus. Boom, 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 boom. And I said, wow. And I went to the piano and I learned the song and I started to realize this song is perfect for the synagogue crowd. And so when I played Exodus, you know, Marvin Slabotsky would pull out Jealousy. Da-da, you know, but I got up at 11 and now Paul Schaefer, and all of a sudden, instead of a little Mozart, you know, I hit with Exodus. And I started to realize the power of covering an auspicious song. And actually, you know, I clobbered him that day. And I guess maybe that was the start of my career as a cover band artist, because I said, you know, gee, you don't have to write your own songs. You know, you can learn Exodus and get a huge reaction from the audience. And basically, I'm still playing Exodus today.
Are you still as competitive as you were with Marvin Slabotsky so many years ago?
I certainly have been throughout my career in my own little quiet way. Out of competition, I guess, does come a certain amount of prowess. It forces you to sit down at that piano and practice.
Who exactly is your competition when you're musical director of Late Night with David Letterman?
Wherever Marvin Slabotsky is, up in Canada somewhere.
You're still just piling it on.
He's saying, I could do that, I could do that. No, I guess I want to be known as a competent band leader. I want my band to be tight, you know, blah, 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 blah. I want, you know, when they hit those things, I want them to be as tight as the great James Brown's band. So perhaps the competition is there, you know. I think I know how to, after all these years, I didn't really know how to conduct a band when Steve Schwartz hired me for Godspell. But I've learned how to do it, and I just want it to be good.
I got one other question for you.
Yeah.
You got an ambition to do something else?
You know, my ambitions are, I play the organ. I love the Hammond organ, and I never really learned how to play the bass pedals on it. And I want to have time to sit down and figure out how to play the pedals so that I can refer to myself as a real organ player, which you're not unless you can play those pedals. And I'd love to learn how to sight read.
What?
I can't sight read. I can read. I can arrange.
We should explain for non-musicians, sight read means somebody drops a piece of music in front of you and you just play it off the page. You can't
right.
do that.
I learned how to play by ear, and I guess I learned how to fake it instead. And I still kind of make my living faking it and playing by ear.
Paul Schaefer, thanks very much. It's been fun talking to you.
It has been my pleasure to be with you, and I hope you enjoy the book.
An excerpt from We'll Be Here for the Rest of Our Lives is at NPR.org. This is NPR News.
The U.S. Chamber of Commerce bills itself as the voice of business, but when it comes to climate change, business no longer speaks with one voice. This week, Apple announced it's quitting the chamber. It joins a handful of other high-profile defectors, as NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
In a letter addressed to the Chamber of Commerce president, Apple said it supports government regulation of greenhouse gases, adding it's frustrating to find the chamber at odds with us in this effort. The chamber opposed the cap-and-trade climate bill that passed the House earlier this year. It also fought against the EPA's recent effort to regulate greenhouse gases. Apple said it would prefer the chamber take what it calls a more progressive stance on climate change. Since it would not, Apple decided its course was to resign its membership immediately. A company spokeswoman declined to comment, but Pete Altman of the Natural Resources Defense Council called it an embarrassing rebuke for the chamber to lose Apple.
This is a company that is seen as an innovator, that is seen as a company that really can see around the next corner and figure out where they need to be. And I think that for a company like Apple to leave the chamber really underscores the fact that the chamber is way behind the curve here.
In a similar move, Nike announced it's quitting the chamber's board of directors, although not its basic membership. And three big utilities, PG&E, Exelon, and PNM Resources, have said they're dropping out of the chamber altogether in protest of its climate change position. Some of the defections may reflect these companies' own business interests. Utilities that rely heavily on nuclear power or that have made big investments in alternative energy could profit from a cap-and-trade system. New Mexico-based PNM Resources still gets most of its electricity from coal-fired power plants, but PNM spokesman Don Brown says his company supported the House bill and was disappointed when the chamber opposed it.
We've been a member of the chamber for 8 years. We had hoped to work within the chamber to influence other members and influence the chamber's position itself, but it became clear to us over time that that wasn't going to happen.
The Chamber of Commerce didn't return NPR's phone calls today, but in a statement last week said it does support strong federal legislation to address climate change. The chamber said it opposed the House bill because it's not comprehensive and doesn't include a binding international agreement. The chamber still boasts some 3 million members and a powerful checkbook. According to the Center for Responsive Politics, the chamber spent nearly $92 million on lobbying last year alone. Little wonder, then, that supporters of climate change legislation are making the most of the chamber's recent losses. Hari Savugan of the Democratic National Committee issued a press release this week trumpeting the departure of the iPhone and iPod maker under the headline, "I Quit."
At times, the chamber holds a very antiquated, outdated view of business.
Some businesses may support climate change legislation because it helps their bottom line. Others because it's part of their marketing strategy. And still others because they feel some kind of regulation is inevitable, and they'd like the predictability that comes from getting it over with. Pete Altman at the Natural Resources Defense Council says the chamber's high-profile defections will make a difference.
The chamber has lost its voice on this issue. When the chamber goes into an office now, the staff and the members are going to know that the U.S. Chamber is not speaking for the entire business community.
And that could be important as the debate over climate change moves to the Senate. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Alyssa Bloch.
And I'm Michelle Norris. North Carolina is one of many states wrestling with the issue of educating illegal immigrants. Its community college system is the second largest in the country. Now, for the fourth time this decade, North Carolina has changed the rules on who can attend. Dave DeWitt of North Carolina Public Radio has the story of how the latest change affects undocumented students.
Roger started in the North Carolina public school system in kindergarten, but it wasn't until he was a junior in high school when the state's community college system banned illegal immigrants like him that he realized all his hard work wouldn't amount to much.
And I got a little disappointed about that.
So when you got disappointed, did it sort of show up in your grades?
It showed up tremendously because I just stopped doing a little bit of homework and stuff, stopped putting too much attention into school. Work because that just like hit me hard, you know.
Roger won't give his last name because he fears being deported to Mexico, a country he barely remembers. He graduated from high school last May and works at a restaurant. He's saving money to try to go to nearby Durham Technical Community College next year, maybe in accounting. He'd better pinch his pennies. North Carolina Community College board members may have just voted to admit undocumented students, but they aren't making it easy.
I'm very pleased with the fact that we have maintained the open door policy that has been the hallmark of the community college system. However, we have established a restraining gate across it.
That's community college board member Stuart Fountain. And the restraining gate is the out-of-state tuition cost illegal immigrants must pay. The $7,000 annual cost is five times that of an in-state resident. Fountain says the board had little option to provide in-state tuition.
There have been court cases in other states in which out-of-state students have sued the community college system in a second state because they were admitting undocumented immigrants at in-state tuition.
The policy changes over the past decade can be traced to the governor's mansion. Former governors like Jim Hunt and Mike Easley supported admission for illegal immigrants. Current Governor Bev Perdue does not. Her decision is largely a political one. About 50 protesters showed up on a warm fall day outside the building where the Community College Board voted. Many held signs asking for motorists to honk their disapproval. They were led by William Gein, an anti-illegal immigration activist.
The Democratic agenda in the state is to provide in-state tuition to illegal immigrants in all of our colleges.
A poll taken earlier this year showed that 75% of North Carolinians do not favor admitting undocumented immigrants. But many educators and Latino support groups say creating an uneducated underclass of citizens will lead to higher crime rates and higher unemployment down the road. Maurizio Castro is an organizer with the North Carolina Latino Coalition. He says having a consistent policy will help Latino students make decisions about their future.
Now that there is this policy, the chances are, and I am hoping and very optimistic, that we also can encourage students to continue their education, because we are clear about the fact that a population without education has a very dark future.
The future for undocumented students in North Carolina might be a little brighter now, but even if some can come up with the out-of-state tuition, it might not be enough to get them on campus. The North Carolina State Legislature may very well change the policy for a fifth time when it reconvenes in May. For NPR News, I'm Dave DeWitt in Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
Safeway's program is a hit with many lawmakers who'd like employers to use it as a model. They added language to the health overhaul bill in the Senate Finance Committee. Some lawmakers call it the Safeway Amendment. The amendment means healthy people could save a lot of money. As NPR's Julie Robner reports, the problem comes with people who might pay more.
Under current rules, wellness programs like Safeway's can only reward workers who lose weight or stop smoking up to a certain amount, 20% of the total cost of their insurance premium. The amendment added to the Finance Committee's health bill could boost those rewards to as much as 50%. The justification is obvious, said Republican sponsor John Ensign of Nevada.
When you offer financial incentives to individuals, they will respond. People are more likely to change behavior if the rewards are even higher.
The amendment passed by a vote of 18-4, but among those opposing it are a long list of groups representing people who have existing health conditions, including the American Cancer Society, American Heart Association, and American Diabetes Association. Dick Woodruff of the Cancer Society says the groups are all for encouraging healthy behavior at the workplace.
The problem is when you begin to tie the incentives to the insurance system and premiums, and when you take a selected number of your employees and give them a deep discount, that cost gets transferred over to the least healthy employees.
Karen Pollitt, an insurance expert at Georgetown University, has been studying some of the wellness plans already on the market. She says that while they say they encourage healthier behavior, some are more of a backdoor way of separating people who are healthy from those who are sick. One plan, she says, starts everyone out with an annual deductible of $2,500, then offers $500 discounts from that total to those who pass tests related to smoking, weight, cholesterol, and blood pressure.
So if you can pass all of the tests, you're back to having a $500 deductible, which is kind of standard for employer plans today. If you can't, if you're unhealthy, you have a $2,500 deductible.
And the result of that is twofold, she says.
One is the unhealthy employees now just have to pay $2,000 more of the cost of their care every year. But second, some of those employees may say, ugh, forget it, I'm going elsewhere.
Both of which save the employer and the insurer money, but don't necessarily improve anyone's health. Pollitt says she also questions just how voluntary these plans would be if employers could vary more of the premium.
This year, the average cost of an employer-sponsored family policy topped $13,000. So an individual's penalty for not voluntarily signing up to participate in this program might be $4,000, $5,000, $6,000 a year. That's pretty coercive.
Dick Woodruff of the American Cancer Society says the groups have another worry about employer wellness programs. Do workers really want their employers to have so much of their personal information?
At least, you know, when you go to the doctor, you have some confidence that the things that you talk about and the things that happen there will be kept confidential. With your employer, you don't.
Woodruff says the groups do support a lot of ways to encourage wellness on the job.
The way to do this is for companies, if they want to have healthy employees, they should offer gym memberships or healthy meals in the cafeteria or opportunities to exercise or whatever.
But backers of the proposal to tie wellness programs to premiums, like Democratic Senator Tom Carper of Delaware, say the language is fair in context with other pieces of the overall health bill.
We've not done a whole heck of a lot with respect to saying to individuals, you know, that we have some responsibility here, too, to do a better job of taking care of ourselves.
It's an argument likely to continue on the Senate floor. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
We're going to hear now from someone whose life and work has been transformed by these Nobel Prize-winning scientists. Annie Griffiths Belt is a photographer for National Geographic. She's taken photos, digital photos, all over the world, and she sent them home high speed thanks to fiber optic cables. Annie Griffiths-Belt joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
When did you make this transition to digital? Do you still have memories of walking across that line to the brave new world?
I have very clear memories of walking into the digital world because photographers are like most people. We're reluctant to change things, and I had an intimate relationship with film for 25 years. But about 5 years ago, I started making the switch because it was clear it was coming like a freight train, and anybody who wanted to continue to work it better get on board.
You say coming like a freight train. I take this was not just a gradual transition. It was more like an earthquake.
It was like an earthquake. In fact, I remember sitting at a photographic seminar at National Geographic when we as a group, the photographers, were presented with this new reality. And there were a lot of crossed arms and crossed eyebrows because people who've been doing something the same way for years were skeptical first and then terrified. 2 years later, it was pretty much everybody was digital.
And has it been liberating? I imagine that sort of from a logistical point of view, it must make things much easier.
It does. I mean, it has been liberating in ways I couldn't possibly have imagined. For example, when I'm working in very remote parts of the world, I can, you know, get home, download things, and send them via email, pictures of themselves. And so in addition to taking the photograph, you can give something back.
I'm wondering, though, if there's a but there. It's been liberating,
but.
I'm wondering if you lose some control because you're not necessarily processing the images yourself in a darkroom. And from what I understand, the printmaking process used to be a great source of pride for photographers.
Oh, the printmaking was a great source of pride and a great source of community, too. I mean, I really think the loss of the darkroom is a big loss. You know, that was the gathering spot where people would look over each other's shoulders and look at their images and give feedback. And there is a loss of control in that this digital information can be interpreted in so many different ways by someone who doesn't have that print or that transparency to look at to make sure that they're reproducing it accurately.
Can you describe for us a moment where digital technology and the ability to transfer those pictures via high-speed fiber optics cable hit home for you?
Oh, yeah. I remember specifically an image that I took on the top of Victoria Falls, where a piece of land emerged only at very, very low times in the river. So I went out with these wonderful guys, local guys, who would go out there and swim, actually, in a swimming hole at the top of Victoria Falls. As we were about to leave, the sun was setting, and I turned around, and one of the guys was standing at the edge of the falls with this kind of spiritual body language. I remember trying to get the shot quickly, and then there was this sort of unbelievable feeling of that evening having it and sending it to the editor. You know, one of the most beautiful, privileged photos I've ever taken, and it was in front of the editor that evening, and that was extraordinary to me.
It sounds sublime. I wonder if you could go in your files and send it off to us via fiber optic cables, and we could post it on the web so our listeners could take a look at it.
Oh, sure, I can. Absolutely, no problem.
Well, Annie Griffiths-Belt, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you.
All the best to you.
You too. Bye-bye.
And sure enough, soon after we talk, Annie Griffiths-Belt sent us that photo from Victoria Falls within minutes. I'm looking at it now on the website. It is sublime. You can see it, too, at npr.org.